Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio,
the voice of American law enforcement,
with your host, Randy Sutton.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. We're on the America Out Loud Network, and I'm your host, Randy Sutton. Thanks so much for joining me. Before we even get started, we do have a great show for you again this week, but I want to acknowledge Blue Lives Matter. BlueLivesMatter.blue is the news and information website for Blue Lives Matter. It's got all the news about law enforcement, and you want to check that out for all of your law enforcement news. Also, Warrior12.com. Warrior12.com is the clothing line and merchandise line for Blue Lives Matter. They've got some of the coolest t-shirts. In fact, I'm wearing one right now, if you could see me. But they have other merchandise as well. So check them out at Warrior12.com. Also, there's JSD Protective Services. JSD Protective Services has all the security needs for you, whether it is for commercial establishments or private security. Check them out at JSD Protective Services. So without further ado, let's take a walk into the briefing room where I'm going to give you my view from the blue. If you have any security needs, no matter what state you're in, the company to call is JSD Protective Services. I've been really impressed with this company. I've met several of the people who are involved in it, and they are quintessential security officers. They really care about what they're doing. This company does everything you could want when it comes to security. They do courier service. They do armed security. They actually do police functions as well with certain contracts that they have. They are private detectives. They have pretty much everything that you could want when it comes down to security. And they do it really well. These guys truly care about what they are putting out. And the owner, Doug Carter is his name, is one of these people that really cares about who he is protecting, who he is serving, and he takes it really seriously. The big difference is their training. It's incredible. They actually have probably more training than many police departments. JSD Protective Services. You want to find them at 844-663-3611. That's 844-663-3611. JSDProtectiveServices.com.
The Briefing Room. Headlines, stories, and all that touches American law enforcement.
Hi, and welcome to The Briefing Room, where I give you my view from the blue, all about current events in today's law enforcement arena. I want to talk to you about one of the greatest injustices that I have seen in a long, long time. It is the settlement of $1.5 million given to the parents of Michael Brown. That's right, the Michael Brown who attacked Officer Darren Wilson in Ferguson after committing a robbery and then attacking the law enforcement officer in his car, beating him, trying to take his weapon. And then Officer Darren Wilson did what he was trained to do. He defended himself. He shot and killed Michael Brown, and it started the ball rolling on one of the worst episodes in law enforcement history, the riots of Ferguson and the false narrative of the hands-up, don't-shoot garbage that came out as a result of this shooting. You will all remember, without a doubt, because this was a very significant time in law enforcement history and in the history of our country. And that is the civil unrest, which began as well as the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement based on the false narrative of hands up, don't shoot. Darren Wilson, the officer who shot Michael Brown, was simply doing his job. And he was doing his job the way he should have been. He made a stop on Michael Brown and his cohort. The cohort is the one responsible for the original lie of hands up, don't shoot. And he attempted to stop him and arrest him. Michael Brown, who was a large man, attacked the officer. And the ensuing investigations, of which there were many, all revealed the same thing, that Darren Wilson did nothing wrong, that Michael Brown was the instigator in this whole debacle, that he was shot when he charged the officer after trying to take his weapon. And even under the Obama administration, Holder White House and Justice Department, they did everything they could to try and prosecute Darren Wilson. They were absolutely unsuccessful in that because he did nothing wrong. But that didn't stop Darren Wilson from having to leave his employment and is still in hiding to this day, years later. He's the real victim of this mess. And the false narrative of hands up, don't shoot was embraced by the liberal media. Must have been repeated 10,000 times in different media outlets. And the ensuing riots, which caused the destruction of a great part of the community of Ferguson, was instigated by Black Lives Matter movement people. They brought in paid protesters. They brought in agitators. They brought in anarchists. And they literally set fire to the community. Now, all this was done, and the father of Michael Brown was famously videotaped screaming, "Burn this MF-er down," referring to his own community. Well, guess what, folks? The city of Ferguson last week announced the settlement of the wrongful death suit against the city of Ferguson, against the former chief of police, Tom Jackson, against Officer Darren Wilson. And instead of taking the high road, instead of fighting this all the way, they acquiesced and they gave $1.5 million to the parents of Michael Brown. Now, let me add this. Michael Brown wasn't even raised by his parents. He was raised by his grandmother because his parents threw him away, basically. And when all of this mess happened, they were nowhere to be seen as far as trying to calm the community. It was just the opposite. They were part of the problem. Why on God's green earth would the city of Ferguson give in to these people and give them $1.5 million? I wouldn't give them 10 cents. And I don't think that a jury would have awarded him a dime. But they gave in. Every time a community does this, every time a community gives away money in order to settle a lawsuit that shouldn't be settled, it just drives the narrative forward that people see this as, well, see, the police must have done something wrong. They just paid $1.5 million. So I understand the fiscal and the political ramifications that, you know, the lawyers are looking at it. But what happens? What happened to standing up for something that you believe in? What happened to standing on principle and saying Michael Brown is the one that attacked a police officer? Michael Brown is the one that set his own fate into the way it all unfolded. I can't imagine the conversations that must have been taking place in the city of Ferguson. Now, I've spoken to Tom Jackson, the chief, and he's just glad that it's over. But it's still because he was being sued personally as well as Darren Wilson. All those lawsuits were dropped. Everything was dropped except for the one that the city settled. And when it comes down to it, they're not getting a whole lot of money because those blood-sucking lawyers, of course, they're going to get a great deal of it as well. So when it comes down to it, each parent isn't going to get a whole lot of money. I mean, well, you know what? Yeah, it is a whole lot of money. Each of them is going to get about $460,000. So the injustice here, that Darren Wilson is still in hiding And Michael Brown's parents are going to be enriched by the death of their thug son is something that is absolutely mind-boggling to me. And of all the cases that should have been, that they should have gone to the wall with, it was this one. Now we have another one that happened this week too, and that's the Philando Castile shooting. Now, this was an entirely different set of circumstances. Castile had a CCW permit. He was carrying a gun. He was stopped in his car with his girlfriend, and there was a child in the car. And the officer from the small town where this took place, I believe it was St. John's, was made a stop on Castile because he resembled the description in a suspect. When he approached, Castile told him that he had a gun. But Castile was under the influence. When they did the autopsy, they found out he was under the influence. He was smoking dope. So the officer tells him not to go for the gun. And you can hear it clearly on the dash cam video and see it, where the officer says, "Don't go for it, don't go for it," and then opened fire and he killed Castile. Now, the difference between the Castile shooting and the Michael Brown shooting, in my estimation, is that Michael Brown had a great intent to harm this police officer. He had attacked him. He had fought over the gun. A round had already been fired in the car while they were wrestling for the gun. Michael Brown physically beat that police officer. And so that shooting was something that is, in my estimation, absolutely clear-cut as far as self-defense. The Castile shooting is different. The perspective of the police officer was that he perceived a threat. And a jury decided that he was not guilty. So this went to, this of course, and you know, let's go back to when this first happened. The officer who shot Castile was a Hispanic officer. Castile was black. And instantly, racism, you know, was front and center of the... in fact, the governor of Minnesota. I mean, what a moron this guy is. This guy, the even before there was any investigation, he comes out and calls it a racist shooting. I mean, talk about a guy that wants to set his own state on fire, for God's sake, without knowing anything. That idiot goes out and he classifies this as a racist police shooting. My God, what an idiot. And it caused, of course, there was rioting, there was all kinds of unrest that resulted from it. And the district attorney, doing the politically correct thing that district attorneys seem to be doing all the time these days, decided to charge the police officer and charge him criminally. There was lots of exculpatory information here as far as when it comes down to charging the officer with a major felony crime, but they did it. They brought him to trial. Well, the jury spoke, and the jury said not guilty. That same afternoon, the police department announced that they were firing that police officer. They were separating him from service. So here's this cop. He does what he thinks is right. He reacts to what he perceives as a threat. As every single police officer knows, there but for the grace of God go I. Perceiving that threat and then acting on it is what cops do to save their own lives. If they hesitate, they die. If they hesitate, someone else may die as well. All those times that police officers interact with people where they perceive threats, it happens every single day. And rarely does it result in a shooting. And when it does, it needs to be looked at. It needs to be investigated. And these type of shootings need to be critiqued. How could it be done better? Were mistakes made? How can we train our police officers better? There's a lot of questions here. So in the Castile shooting, it was different than the Michael Brown. But the mother of Castile, when the jury announced the verdict, she came out and she did this Facebook post that is absolutely excruciating to watch, where she's calling for violence. She's the mother of this guy. And what are they? And 3 days later, they gave her $3 million. $3 million. You got to be kidding me. So the injustice that takes place over and over and over again with communities that don't have the guts to stand up for themselves. Look, I understand why they would give a settlement. I get it. The civil court is the, in my estimation, was the right place to look at the Castile shooting. This through the civil court, not the criminal court. The officer shouldn't have been charged with a major felony crime. But they did because of the political correctness of the moment. And this seems to be the trend. Let's take another look at the Betty Shelby case that just happened only a couple months ago. Betty Shelby was the Tulsa police officer who shot and killed the suspect on the highway who was laden with PCP, who was reaching into his truck against all orders not to do so. And turned out he did not have a gun, but Officer Shelby, believing that he did, fired around and shot him, killed him. Well, the jury spoke in there too. Not guilty. This is what we're seeing, that prosecutors are overcharging police officers for political reasons. Not because of justice, not because the state will be served by the prosecution and imprisonment of these police officers, but because it's politically expedient to do so. There's a case going on right now, where a New York City police sergeant responding to a disturbed person was attacked by an elderly woman with a baseball bat. He had de-escalated it and thought he had calmed her down, and all of a sudden she grabs the bat and she tries to beat his brains out with it, and he shot her and killed her. Well, the district attorney in New York has now charged him with murder. Murder! Not even manslaughter, for God's sake. Murder! This is... There is no excuse for this. And why are they doing it? Because it's politics. The lives of police officers are on the line every single day. Hesitation kills. Hesitation to save your own life or defend yourself kills police officers. And this is what is going on all over the country. Cops are looking at these cases. They're looking at the people just like themselves ruining their lives, being arrested, destroying their careers, and then they're saying to themselves, well, what am I doing this for? Why am I going out there every single day risking my own life, working my butt off, and then risking everything that I hold dear in my life? And that, my friends, is why we are seeing the backing off of aggressive policing in our nation. And as a result of that, we're seeing crime spiral out of control in the major cities. We are seeing violence bubble up in places where they are setting records for murder and for violent assaults. And at the same time, we're seeing police officers not aggressively going out and taking care of business. Let me tell you, folks, proactive policing is where crime is solved. That's making the car stops for no license plate lights and trying to find a fugitive. That's making the car stop for no turn signal while you're examining the people in the car looking for any signs of criminality. That's how police work is done effectively. If we take that away from our nation by this intolerable persecution of law enforcement officers, it's the nation that's going to suffer. It's the people. It's the good people who are going to suffer. Because let's face it, when the cops back away, who is getting hurt? It's the people that they serve. And that's why this is such a double-edged sword. Law enforcement officers need to protect themselves. They need to protect themselves physically. They need to protect themselves psychologically, emotionally. They need to protect their careers. And it's becoming more and more difficult every single day because of the political climate and because of police leaders and political leaders who don't have the guts to stand up for their own people. The other thing that I want to talk about today is actually, I think it's something good. And that is that the state of New Jersey, my home state, has passed a law. It hasn't been signed into law yet, but they've passed a bill that school districts must start teaching kids how to talk to law enforcement officers, starting in kindergarten, and this instruction continues all the way to grade 12. The mandate is the Department of Education must work with a committee to create the curriculum. Now, I think this is fantastic for a lot of different reasons. First of all, it will give police officers the ability to interact with kids in school much more than they're doing so now. Secondly, it will bring forth into the schools a conversation about law enforcement that needs to happen. It needs to happen. The kids aren't being taught within the home in many circumstances about what happens when you get stopped by a cop. I don't see anything except positive out of this. But of course, that's not the politically correct thing, apparently, because let me read a couple of the comments that came out. This is from Sheila Oliver, the New Jersey Assemblywoman. She said the bill is about prepping kids for their interactions with the police. And then she says, the number of police-related shootings around the nation have created a mistrust of police in many communities. This can help rebuild the trust that is essential for law enforcement to work. This is a lesson many parents already teach to their children. Making a part of the school curriculum is the next logical step. So she's for it. She's a proponent of it. But then you go to here's another one. This was on NBC News. New Jersey teacher and activist. I love that word, activist. Quote, this legislation does not empower young people. I love that. The empower word, that's the latest buzzword, you know. They empower young people, especially those living in brown and black communities. Instead, it empowers law enforcement by allowing them to continue to evade accountability for abuse and misconduct while forcing the burden on the public. Now, there's the victim mentality right there. Instead of seeing something positive here, she's claiming that it's once again, it's the police. It's their fault. Everything is the police's fault. But I think this is a good law. I think that there's other states that are looking at it. And I think that anything that allows interaction between the police and the communities that they serve is nothing but a positive. That, my friends, is this week's View from the Blue. And let's take a walk into the interview room for the next phase of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement.
We are one of the fastest growing podcast and talk radio networks in the world. You're listening to the America Out Loud Talk Radio Network. It's where we say, let the silent voices be heard. And we stand proudly with the men and women who serve in our armed forces and our law enforcement heroes. Thank you for being part of our family. And we'll see you back at AmericaOutLoud.com.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
With me today on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, is an author and a speaker, someone who has made a real difference in the lives of police officers around the country with her words and her deeds. Her name is Victoria Newman, and she is the author of, amongst other books, How to Love Your Cop. She's also the author of A Chip on My Shoulder, which is coming very soon. It's going to be published in July. So I want to thank you so much for being on Blue Lives Radio. Welcome, Vicki.
Thanks for having me, Randy.
So you've been writing for a while on law enforcement topics, and How to Love Your Cop, I think, has changed a lot of lives.
Yeah, actually, How to Love Your Cop is our organization, and that is also the tagline of A Chip on My Shoulder. So Chip on My Shoulder was actually the first book that I wrote, and that was about my husband's and my story. And we just found some themes within our lives that correlated with other law enforcement families. And we wrote that book, and suddenly everybody was just like, wow, this is my story too.
Tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, my husband and I, we've been married 29 years, and 5 weeks into our marriage, he went into the California Highway Patrol Academy. And so we went through that. We had kind of a honeymoon marriage for 6 months, I believe, and then promptly moved to LA. And we've been kind of moving all over California ever since. As an officer, and then he promoted up through the ranks. He's now a chief, and I've been just kind of hanging along with him. And we've brought in some kids, and in the process, I saw him change, kind of transform into this person that I didn't really know before. And we had to deal with that in our marriage and in our lives together. So that's what Chip on My Shoulder is all about.
And I think that there isn't one relative or wife or husband of a law enforcement officer that wouldn't recognize that same thing has happened throughout their marriage as well. And I think that's really the crux of what you speak about and write about, is how to keep that marriage strong and get through these. The police career is not an easy career to deal with.
Yeah, that's the understatement of the year.
I'd rather understate than overstate.
Yeah. No, it has. It's been we've had a wild adventure, some great things throughout the career, and then we've had some things that are difficult, and the job has been a big part of our lives together, and it dictates everywhere from where we're living to how we raise our children to where he sits in a restaurant, and I can't even put the dry cleaning in the back seat now. I put it in the trunk. So it dictates a lot of different things in those at home in our lives.
Your book, your first book, how was that received?
Incredibly. In fact, I was surprised by it. It came out, and then instantly I'm hearing from people from Maine and Florida and all over the United States. I don't even know how that happened. I think it was word of mouth and a little tiny bit of social media where people just were like, there's nothing for us, and finally there's somebody who has given us a voice, and I'm not alone. And suddenly I'm getting letters from all over the United States.
And is that, was that what, when you realized that that speaking on this topic would be also an avenue to reach people?
Yes, I all of a sudden I'm on a plane going to these different places, to places I've never been, speaking to people I've never met. And I kind of had to learn on the fly. And that was 6 years ago. And so I'm doing it as more now than I ever have. And so the message is, people receive it with like, oh, this is like a cool drink of water, because I'm positive about the life. There are some challenges with this life, but there's also a lot of great things. And my thing has always been to have a positive attitude, to love our officers with our attitude. And that means, you know, supporting the career and supporting who they are as men and women, and coming alongside and figuring out what my role is and my significance in, you know, supporting the Thin Blue Line.
You know, one thing that is been a very, in my own career, I noticed, I started when I was 19 years old, so I was very, very young.
Wow.
I know. And you know, I think about some of the decisions I made as a 19-year-old cop. And then, you know, it lasted more than three decades. But
wow.
The changes that I saw in myself during those decades, no one walks into this career believing that they're going to change so much, but no one walks out of this career not changed. How, as a, I can't speak from experience because I've never been married.
Oh, and okay.
I know, I'm one of those guys. I live with a couple cats and I've never been married. So you draw your own conclusions from that weirdness.
Oh, boy,
but,
okay.
But you know, I have seen the divorce rate amongst cops is crazy.
Yep.
The family lives are constantly uprooted, and sometimes you may have found this. It depends on what geographical part of the country you're a policeman in, can also have play a role.
Yes, and what the job is. I mean, what they're doing on the department. And also departments. So like in, you know, here in California. There are departments that have as high as a 90% divorce rate, but then
wow.
there are others that are not so high, not that high. So it does average out, obviously, but I don't know why that is. I don't know if it's culture. In fact, somebody was asking me this this weekend. Why is that? Why is, you know, San Jose PD, I think I may be off now with the numbers, but at one point, a few years back, it was 91% divorce rate.
Wow.
In San Jose. And why is that? I have no idea. I don't know. I wish I did, because then I could speak to that when I go out there. But it does depend, and it's somewhat individualized, but I will tell you that there are themes that run through Secret Service, through DEA agents, through California Highway Patrol, through, you know, the street cop. There are themes that run all the way through. And I'm even starting to see that within other countries now, too, as this has expanded just a little bit. I'm talking with those from Canada and Australia, and there's just and the Philippines, there's just some different, you know, cultural things that play into that, and the way that they're received in their country, how they're perceived. You know, some don't carry guns. It's just very interesting. So, but there are themes that affect the marriage that are very universal.
Well, when you go out and do speaking engagements, who is your audience, basically?
Mostly, I've done spouses, but it's becoming more and more often that I'm speaking to officers as well.
As couples?
No, sometimes they'll bring me in to just speak to officers, and then, boy, that's intimidating. It's a spouse, you know. A lot of times when I speak to spouses, we open it up. And recently I've seen a lot more of their husbands coming in, and I have to wonder, they're like, okay, what is she going to say? And is this okay? And, you know, when I first started speaking, there was always a few cops in the back in uniform with their arms crossed. And
yeah, I hear you.
And by the end, they'd be coming up to me afterwards and going, wow, I never thought about that before. In fact, one time I was in the Bay Area doing I just had probably about 25 people there, but there was an officer and his wife who just, for some reason, they sat right in the front row, and we weren't even into it in an hour, and he had to excuse himself because he was weeping. And you know, I never got a chance to talk to him one-on-one. But I can only imagine, you know, there's a lot of hurt, on both sides, you know, and that's what I'm trying to do, is to help so that we can understand, have the conversations, increase our communication. And so that we're working together instead of working against, as we go through, this police life.
Well, you know, even the name of your one book and the name of your organization, How to Love Your Cop, and by the way, for my listeners, it's How and then the number to Love Your Cop, so if you want to look that up. Even that name alone is, it's a powerful name, because it's a topic that I don't think anyone, when they get into a marriage with a law enforcement officer or a long-term relationship, it's not something that is conscious. It's, you know, they get into a relationship and suddenly they realize that there's all these challenges.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I talk about that in A Chip on My Shoulder. And then I also talk about that in A Marriage in Progress, because that one is actually for officers. The first one, A Chip on My Shoulder, is for spouses. And so that one, you know, talks to spouses and kind of, you know, talks about the career and what that means for those of us who are at home, and you know, some of those challenges, looking at them, but then looking at ways to deal with them positively, to kind of help come alongside, you know, fight against some of those things that are not good for our officers. And then in Marriage in Progress, then I turn it and talk to the officer about, you know, just some things that you may be doing that are perceived differently than what you mean. There's this old adage where, well, I don't want to bring my job home. I don't want to talk to my spouse. I don't want to tell her or him what I've experienced that day, because I've relived it, or I've lived it through what once. I don't want to live through it again. But then they expect that because they don't say anything, that the job isn't actually there. Well, it is. And it's in those changes that we were referring to earlier. It's in the separation that happens when you don't talk, that isolation. I mean, I have heard some stories that would just make you cry. Of people who are living in the same house, and there are so many issues that, because they haven't talked about them, you know, things from the job, things from interaction at home, and or non-interaction, and they're living in different rooms, in different parts of the house, and that's so isolating. And how much better would it be to share with the one who knows you the best about what you're going through, and then have it be received well, because she or he has been, you know, educated about what you are seeing out there, And, you know, we don't need all the details. We don't need all the gory details, but we do need to know when some things are bothering you.
You know, you've touched on, I think, probably one of the most important topics of this type of relationship. And that is, I know from talking to my contemporaries, you know, over the career, how there was a wide variety of the way the officers dealt with the traumas that they saw every day. Mm-hmm. And they truly, many of them truly believed that if they brought that home with them, that they were going to infect their family with that kind of trauma. And so they wanted to protect them from it. But at the same time, what they're doing is they are bottling it up and they're damaging themselves internally, psychologically and emotionally.
And that in turn sabotages the relationship. It sabotages intimacy. It sabotages communication. And I'll just tell you, us spouses, if you're not saying something, we fill in the blanks, and it's usually wrong.
Right.
Because we don't understand the opposite sex a lot of times in our thinking. And so my husband has come home from things and he's shut down. He's angry. He just doesn't want to talk. And I can early on, before I really kind of was educated about this and learned more, I thought it was me. I thought, well, maybe he's having an affair. These were the things that I was thinking. Because I didn't understand the psychological effects of seeing shit on the road. I mean, he was seeing all kinds of stuff. And if you don't have a way to flush that before you come home, you got to flush it at some point, or you bottle it up. And then I misunderstand. And then I create drama.
Yeah, exactly. And on the other side of this equation, though, I have also seen in social situations, wives of friends of mine who for whatever reason just seem to verbally attack them all the time for, oh, you know, he's never home. He's, you know, the stuff that comes with the job. And so that has an effect of separating emotionally, and I mean, I've seen guys that just will walk away and go to another side of the room and start hanging out with their buddies because they don't want to be with their wife.
Yep, and that's my job. That's what I do, is to educate spouses as to what this life means and our significance emotionally and relationally in this life. And it's different. Marriage is hard for everybody, right? I mean, you're taking two different individuals and trying to make one life together. And there's a lot of things, you know, there's a lot of give and take there. There's a lot of learning about each other and how, you know, the best ways to communicate and to cooperate. And you know, a lot of us are just not good at that naturally, and we have to learn. And
maybe that's why I never got married.
Well, maybe so. Who knows? But it does. It's work. But then you add some of these challenges of shift work, and a lot of times spouses are lonely, and they're worried, they're fearful, my husband and I, we also mentor people one-on-one locally. And then I do some stuff online too, but we mentored a couple where they got married and he was a social worker, and then he didn't like it. He wanted to be a cop. So he became a cop. And then as soon as he did that, then he got laid off because of some budgetary concerns and cutbacks and whatnot. And then they rehired him a short time after that, but that caused a lot of problems early on when they're trying to establish their relationship. So she, in that, she was bitter. She saw him change. She did not want to have anything to do with policing, nothing. And so she didn't. She basically refused to listen, didn't want to hear anything. You are a cop out there. You're not a cop when you come home. And you can imagine what happened. I mean, we started mentoring them, and I, you know, she's just like one of those people who was very, very, you know, the complaining and the bad mouthing in front of other people. And he ended up having an affair, and they almost lost their marriage. And she changed her mind. She went on a ride along. She decided that she wanted to fight for their marriage, and she understood that she needed to get educated, that she needed to come alongside him as a cop through and through, not just when he was on duty, but when he was at home, and to understand what that means. And they are doing amazing.
That's a happy story.
Yes.
I was thinking it was going to go the other way.
Me too. Me too. Because
they're not all happy stories.
No. And I've had to come to grips with that. You know, some people, they seek help too late, you know, too much too late, and they're done. And I've learned to recognize that look in their eyes of where, yeah, I'm done. You know, we could try, but you know what, I'm just not in this. And, you know, that happens. That's why the divorce rate is so high. But the things, you know, everybody suffers. That's a painful thing. A divorce is a very, very painful thing, not just for the two that are getting divorced, but the children, the extended family, sure. And, you know, and friends. I mean, it's, you know, there's some people that are close to us that are going through divorces or have gone through divorces, and it hurts. It hurts even us. So I'm trying to help people so that they don't have to get to that point.
Let me ask you this. How has post-traumatic stress injury, I'm sure that you have seen correlations between that and the relationship issues that come to you?
Absolutely. And we will be, as an organization, we will be addressing that more and more, because I just brought on a couple who are dealing with that right now in an incident that happened here in Sacramento a couple years ago. And they are, you know, seeking help and support through different avenues that are available to them. And so they're doing this right, as you know, those of us who are trying to, you know, increase education and help, they're doing things right, and then we're going to be writing their story and making that available. But so we're going to be getting into that more. But there is a gal who had been going through post-traumatic stress with her medically retired husband. His injury was post-traumatic stress. And she has been, bless her heart, just totally in this to the end. And they're still at it. But he's had severe post-traumatic stress. He worked for the federal government in the sex trafficking trade undercover for years. And they are still struggling through it and learning how to come alongside someone who is dealing with that. It's a huge problem, and we're just now coming. You know, I think the first thing is to address the post-traumatic stress and to get help for that. But also to come alongside spouses in that and help them to educate them on how to respond and how to support and how to also protect themselves. because, you know, post-traumatic stress, that can really complicate behavior. And it's hard. It's hard on kids, and it's hard on spouses.
Yeah, without a doubt. And it's one of those, you know, still to this day, we haven't figured out as a profession how to deal with post-traumatic stress injury. There's still stigma attached to it. There's still a reluctance to seek treatment for it, even though there is effective treatment. So this is one of those dark little secrets that unfortunately affects every portion of the life, especially relationships.
Yeah, exactly. I have post-traumatic stress in my family, not my husband, but in my family through the military. And so this has been something early on that I have been very interested in and passionate about. And I've been learning. Now, you mentioned the book Selfish Prayer. That is a military book. And that was the medevac, medevac unit that were in Afghanistan in the year 2009. And so not only was I, you know, dealing with my son through post-traumatic stress and other people in my family, but I was also interviewing these guys who had been saturated in war and you know, as medics, flight medics over in Afghanistan. And so for a couple of years, it was just, I was saturated with post-traumatic stress and just how that affects not only them, but family members. And how, you know, the triggers and how we can either exasperate or come alongside or and just being educated on how to recognize what's happening when there's conflict. And by conflict, I mean, you know, nightmares or outbursts or the ways that people are dealing with things. And so it's been I've been getting an education along the side, and then talking with women. You're right. We need more. We need to normalize it because it's rampant. Whether people, admit it or not, it is rampant within law enforcement, and I think even more so with everything that we've been going through as a law enforcement community in the last 3 years since Ferguson, right, in particular. Mm-hmm. And because it's exasperated when you don't have support. I mean, where do you go? You know, if you don't have support within, from the media, you don't have support from the public, you don't have support from your leadership. I mean, seriously?
Yeah, it poses more and more problems on the individual officers because they don't know who to turn to. They don't know who to trust. And that carries over into your family life as well.
Yes. And if we as family members don't know how to come alongside and how to support and we're misreading things, what a disaster, you know? And so that is why I wrote the books that I've written. That it's not just the post-traumatic stress. We were, as a department, really undergoing a lot of suicide alongside line of duty deaths. So it was just getting very dire when I set out to write this book, my first book. And so, you know, there's a lot that we can do in the education piece. And so
that's what you're doing. That's the role that you were fulfilling. So as we are kind of running out of time here, once again, tell the audience your books and your website.
Okay, my website is www.howtoloveyourcop.com. And my books are A Chip on My Shoulder, How to Love Your Cop with Attitude. That's the first one. There is A Marriage in Progress, Tactical Support for Law Enforcement Relationships. That's the companion book. That's for officers. The first one, Chip on My Shoulders, for spouses. And then I do have the military book that is, it's not my story, but it's another story. And that does, that's military, but it does have some law enforcement stuff in there, as well as just the emotional toil of war. And so it addresses that as well.
Where can they get your books?
All on Amazon.com.
Don't we love Amazon? Thank God
yes,
for Amazon.
Yes, we do. Yeah, they're all there. Chip on My Shoulder, I'm rewriting right now, so it's sold out in its current state. And so that will be coming out in July of 2017.
Okay, so for my listeners, if you go on to Amazon.com and you Google Victoria Newman, N-E-W-M-A-N, yes. All her books will pop up there. And
yes.
I appreciate what you do. I know that it comes from your heart, and you're really fulfilling a tremendous need in the law enforcement community. And I wish you the best, and I'm sure that we will be working together.
Yes, I'd like that. Thank you, Randy. I appreciate it.
Each week on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we honor those men and women of the law enforcement community who have given their lives in the line of duty. This week, I have one name to read. His name is Master Sergeant William Trampas Bishop. He is of the Florida Highway Patrol. Master Sergeant William Bishop was struck and killed by a vehicle while investigating an accident on I-75 in Alachua County. He was outside of his vehicle when a secondary accident occurred in the center lane at approximately 6:35. One of the vehicles involved in the secondary accident then struck Sergeant Bishop, pinning him underneath it. He served with the Highway Patrol for 30 years. He is survived by his wife and son, Master Sergeant William Trampas Bishop. End of watch, Saturday, June 17th, 2017. Hey, I want to thank you so much for tuning in this week to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. You know, we couldn't have done this without our sponsors. That is BlueLivesMatter.blue. That's the news and information website for Blue Lives Matter. JSD Protective Services, which is the best security company I know, and also Warrior 12. Warrior12.com is the clothing line and the merchandise line for Blue Lives Matter. They got the best t-shirts. They got these really cool things called Yeti cups. I just found out about them, and all kinds of other cool stuff. So go to Warrior12.com and check out their stuff. Also, in case you didn't know it, I'm an author, and I've got a number of books. If you go to Amazon.com, put my name in there, and you'll find all my books, including A Cop's Life, True Blue, to and all my other stuff. So check it out, and thanks so much. I will see you. Well, I won't see you, but you'll hear me next week on Blue Lives Radio. Thanks.